Welcome to KGXT, Gen X Talks podcast, live from Central California. Making plans with the boys. I'm going to hit the town. Yeah, I'm going to make some noise. I'll push past the pain and my wounded pride. I'm going to live it up. Yeah, stay out all night. But sure, I've had some better times. And I can't.
We have a special guest in studio today, Marine Corps Staff Sergeant stationed at Camp Pendleton, and my son-in-law. So, means a couple things. One, that everything he's telling us is going to be the truth, because he's not allowed to lie to his father-in-law. And number two, I don't have to pay him. That's a convenience of family. So, let's go to the right over here. Mike, welcome to the program. I know I didn't get you up early, because you wake up at oh God early all the time. But I wanted to say thank you for taking time. I know you got a busy weekend planned. You're trying to get out of here and get back on the road. But before you go, I want to try to encapsulate some of the stuff you and I have been talking about off and on for months, really. But let's, before we begin, tell everybody what rank, what your job is, what your rank and title is at your work.
So I actually just got selected for Staff Sergeant, so I'm about to pick up rank. I'm an avionics technician. So this is just a fancy way of saying electrical work on aircraft, and I work on helicopters, H-1 platform.
Is that the only thing you work on, is just the helicopters, or do you branch out into other stuff too?
That's more or less the only thing I work on, but it's the nature of the beast for the Marine Corps for you to kind of get pulled and dragged to do other things as well. So
I got you. Well, let's go back to the beginning. First of all, what made you want to enlist in the Marine Corps, and when was boot camp for you? How long ago?
Yeah, so I joined the Marine Corps. I'd always wanted to join the Marine Corps. My dad was in the Marine Corps. I knew I was not intelligent enough to go to school or do anything like that. So I knew I wanted to join the Marine Corps. I joined straight out of high school in 2015.
So you've been in there a bit now. You got some time under your belt.
Yeah, I've been there for a little while now.
Well, how was boot camp? I mean, was that Marine Corps is in the family, was that an eye-opening experience, or were you pretty prepared for it? Because I've heard stories. I've never been through basic training anyway, but when you hear, people always come out and go, that was a lot tougher than I thought. That was an eye-opening experience. Was it that way for you?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's definitely nothing that can really prepare you for, like, you know, that kind of experience. It's different. And I don't know what I could even compare it to, but I feel there is an aspect of it that's kind of, I don't know if I'd say easy, but your life is very structured. You know, you're told where to be and when to be there. So, and you just go where you need to be and you just do it.
But it can't be for everyone. You can't. I don't get the impression that basic training is, don't worry, we've told you when to eat, when to shower, when to shave. You're going to be fine. I got to think that it's not easy. I got to think people drop out.
Yeah, it's definitely not for everybody. I feel like it just takes, as long as you have that mindset of just being you're going to take on whatever challenge is put in front of you. And then you just, you know, they'll put those challenges in front of you and you just do what you can to knock it out.
And what happens after basic training, after boot camp? Is there some sort of a tech school when you choose what you're going to be doing? Don't they send you off to some sort of training for the area you've been recruited for?
Yes. So for the Marine Corps and the Marine Corps only, after you go to boot camp, If your job is not to be like a basic infantryman, right, like you're not going to just go be, you know, shoot people on the front line.
Right.
You first go to what's called MCT, which is Marine Corps Combat Training, and you get kind of basic combat training. And that's about a month long. And that's for everybody.
Everybody does
that. Because the Marine Corps, every Marine's a rifleman. So you go to that. It's about a month long. And then after that, you go to your like job specific tech school.
Now, is it true there's just two places you can do training in the United States from basic training? Is it Pendleton? Camp Pendleton's one. Is the other one back east?
So there's one. It's actually in San Diego. It's right next to the San Diego airport. If you do that one, you do go to Camp Pendleton for a few weeks of your training, right. And then the other one is in
Camp Lejeune. Camp Lejeune, or no? Is that
Parris Island.
Parris Island.
All yep. Right. It's up in that area, but it's its own.
But there's just two places. That's the only.
Just the two places.
Because the Army, I understand, has many places you can do your basic. They have a lot of bases you can do basic training. It isn't just like one or two places, because I've heard different names of camps that they went to. So, but I figured the Marine Corps was more focused on two places.
Yeah.
Where did you do your schooling after that? You left San Diego when you were done. Where'd you go for training, or were you, was it all there?
Now, so the Marine Corps combat training, the MCT that you do, it's very similar. It's based. So if you went to the San Diego one, then you go to Camp Pendleton. And if you were in Parris Island, then that's where you go and do your MCT as well.
All right.
And then for me personally, because my job is so like specific yeah. And like, yeah, you know, I'm going to be working on helicopters. My schooling was in two different places. So first I went to Pensacola, Florida, and I was there for a few months. And there they kind of taught me like basic electronics and then like basic... like how like aircraft integrate electronics.
Right.
And then when I graduated that, I got to pick like what specific aircraft I would be actually working on.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I went to a school that was specific to that aircraft.
Why did you pick helicopters? You could have picked a lot of stuff. There's a lot of choices out there, wasn't there?
Well, so in my case, there wasn't. So it just depends. So for me, there was 7 Marines in my class, and there was 6 orders for helicopters and 1 order for Harriers.
Oh.
Yeah. So like you could go.
Yeah.
And there could be a plethora of options. They could have like everything available to you.
Right.
Or they could have nothing available.
Well, that was it's kind of a running joke I've heard for years, and I don't know if this is true of me. They always say that the Marine Corps' equipment is the Navy's hand-me-downs, is the Army's hand-me-down, is the Air Force's. When the Air Force gets a new helicopter, then they scrap the old ones, and that's the one you guys get. Now, that's always been the running joke my entire life, because I've had friends in all branches of the military. Is that a joke, or is that really true? You guys get the old stuff.
It's true, kind of like in the idea of it, less like specifically. We just don't get as fancy of things that say the Air Force would get. The stuff we're getting isn't like, oh, it was used by the Air Force and now it's given to us.
It's not like something from the 80s.
Yeah, it's not like some old school thing. It's just, you know.
Well, that was always one of the running jokes that was, you know, that you just hear when you bar talking going around. The other one is this. Now, I know you talked to me about, and we'll get to what you're doing later, where you're going with this. But, you know, there's in the Army, there are specific jobs called non-deployable positions. Once you get a job, it's like you're not going anywhere. And I used to talk to some of my Marine Corps buddies about that before in the past. And they said, well, I'm working my way towards this. And you know, I said, well, is that a non-deployable position? And they said, well, technically, it is that they're in the Marine Corps. There is non-deployable positions. You're not going to go do something. But they always, every one of these soldiers came back and said, just so you know, that's an Army term. Okay. You are always a Marine, no matter what. If it comes down to it, they don't care what you're doing. They will put a gun in your hand and tell you go that way. There is no Marine job that is truly a non-deployable position, because you are a soldier, you are a Marine first, then your job. That's the way they described it. Would you characterize that as fairly accurate?
That's definitely accurate for the Marine Corps. It's like even just going back to what I was saying, like after your basic boot camp, you still go, everybody, regardless, you could be an admin Marine where your job is going to be data entry.
Right.
You're going to go to that combat training.
See, that's
gonna
get basics. That was the difference in the Army. I've known one of my sons was in the Army, and a stepson that was in the Army too. They were both working towards non-deployable positions at the time, but they were very clear. No, I don't have to go anywhere. There's enough soldiers in the Army that they can send infantry. I'm not going. I'm my weapon is now a pen, and I sit at a desk. So I thought that was a very unique and distinct thing for the Marine Corps. You know, and everyone said it with pride. They didn't say it begrudgingly. I never heard one soldier say, "Well, I have to go fight if I had." Every one of them proudly said, "I'm always a soldier first. I will go fight. Now, my job over here is this, but I'm always a Marine first." I like that. I like that there was some pride, a little prestige that your branch was that way. I like that.
Yeah.
So there you are. You get your tech school done after your basic training. You got your stuff. And where's your first assignment? Where do you first show up for work with your tool belt and say, "Okay, I'm here. Got my foot locker and my tools. Let's go."
The first place that I went, and it's actually been the only place I've been the whole time, was Camp Pendleton, California. For the aircraft that I work on, there's very limited places that you can go, and the majority of the squadrons that fly those helicopters are on Camp Pendleton.
Well, you know, you've shown me some pictures of things you're working on, just what the aircraft look like. The same stuff you'd find on Google if I knew where to look for the things you've talked about. You know, it's public information, I'm sure. But I can't believe some of the high-tech stuff and dollar amount. Like, even there was one part, and I'll mess this up, so you got to guide me here. But there was one part of the aircraft that had to do with some sort of laser or computer or radar thing. You said, "You guys don't even touch it. You guys take it out, send it out to be fixed, and they send you back a piece." And the cost was enormous. But you also said, "But it's the bitchinest shit in the world. Nobody's got this." What was that? What kind of, you don't have to tell me the details, but what was that?
Yeah, so if I remember correctly, we're just kind of referring to like a forward-looking sensor.
That's it. Like, so, yeah, that's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's like definitely stuff on there that, like, even with how long I've been working there, I couldn't tell you exactly how some of this stuff works. I can tell you when it's not working and that it needs to be sent to the people who developed and manufactured it so that they can fix it for us. But yeah,
that definitely isn't secondhand stuff.
Yeah, definitely not secondhand stuff.
That's Marine Corps state of the art. You know, you guys got the cutting edge technology, as good as anybody in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing stuff right there. Do you ever deal with anything in your job description when you're working on the helicopters with any sort of live ammunition, or is that all taken off before they roll the helicopter into your bay to be worked on? Or is there a weapons area of weapons helicopter guys? They just deal with ordnance, or is that for all of you?
So there is an ordnance shop, and their primary job is to load on ammunition, unload ammunition. On any military flight line, there's what's called a Kayla, and how it works is, like, our aircraft, they'll turn up, they'll get ready, they'll launch from the standard flight line where we work, where our hangars are.
Right.
They fly over to the Kayla. That's where all the ammunition is loaded onto it. Because there's got to
be somebody that makes sure the bullets work, you know, that the guns fire, that the missiles can be fired correctly, right? I mean, there's got to be a crew that does that.
Camp Pendleton, as big of a base that it is, the majority of Camp Pendleton is a range.
Ah.
Yeah.
You know, I drove down to saw your wife and my daughter one time. I had to go down to San Diego a couple times to pick up some things, and I'm going along the coast, and I didn't, now I'm near Pendleton. I'm going south, so the ocean's to my right, the beach is to my right. I'm near Pendleton, but I can't believe that I was looking at, the beach was only 100, 200 yards wide, and your guys are down there, helicopters and jumping out of, coming down ropes and picking up blocks of things, and there's people running. I mean, they were doing exercises right on the beach. I'm thinking, okay, first of all, my thought was, well, those guys can go wherever they want. You know, no one's going to tell the Marine Corps, "Hey, you're not, I'm fishing here, man. You can't train here." No one's going to tell you guys that, but how far up the coast could you guys do exercises and practice stuff?
Yeah, so that area that you're talking about, when you're driving down the 5, to the right, the beach, to the left, you know, kind of little mountainous hills, that's Camp Pendleton. Camp Pendleton owns those beaches. Those are
the 5 interstate goes right through it.
Goes through it.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That blew me away. I'm like, okay, you guys are, we're 100 yards from where I'm driving, and I'm quite sure this has got to be campground somewhere in here. And I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds of you guys, and they were literally, I just happened to go by when they had there was helicopter, what do they call the ones with two blades?
Ospreys.
They had 3 or 4 of those, and guys going down ropes. to the ground. I mean, quickly. And then there was one further up that was picking up. It's like you guys put up these big containers, and I saw the helicopter latching, the guys latching stuff onto it, and then it pulling it up. It was probably like learning how to deploy things and put things back on. But they were fast, man. I didn't expect to see, you know, Marine Corps readiness exercises while I was driving to San Diego, but there it was.
Yeah, right. The thing that the Marine Corps probably prides himself the most in is like amphibious landings. So like being out at sea and going to shore is something that we practice regularly.
Well, since you brought that up, a couple years ago, it was on the news. That didn't go so well.
Yeah.
You guys, now, there was an accident where one or two of those things sank to the bottom of the ocean with some soldiers in it. It was all over the news. And what was the vehicle called? Because I can't remember. The amphibious landing vehicle.
Yeah, amphibious landing vehicle.
And they were older. Those weren't, in the news, they said these were older units. They're they're prone to leaking, but they have pumps that keep them, you know, keep water out, but that's just kind of how it goes. And there was a lot of soldiers that came on the news at that time and said out loud, said, well, you know, we're always worried about that because these things do leak. They are old. They're just training vehicles. And then it ends up one or two of them sank. And one of the guys was from my family's hometown up in Oregon. He had just got out of basic. He was 20 years old, 19 years old, I think. And he didn't make it out of there. Now, were you, how close were you on that exercise? Weren't you there?
Yeah, so I was actually on the boat that they had launched from and that they were coming back to. And I remember, I was on the boat. I was on the flight deck. You know, just doing my thing that day, working on the helicopters, and the Navy started launching like little rescue boats, and I didn't even know that something was actually happening. I thought that the Navy was just doing some like training. Oh, hey, let's drill. Yeah, let's practice. This is going on, and then you could kind of see out in the distance like one of those things. A little bit more submerged than it usually would be, and then you kind of started to realize like, oh dang, like
there's
something, yeah, there's a problem, something's happening. And they got out there and they got to everybody they could, and they brought them on deck, and you know, there was Navy corpsmen running around over the place doing everything they could.
But once those things go down, you don't have, I mean, you can only hold your breath for so long. And even though the Navy's the best in the world at rescue, there's just, you can't get somebody down there quick enough. There was a big backlash for a few weeks on that. I remember arguing with people personally. They're like, oh, the Navy and the Marine Corps, and we got to shut this down and we got to stop. And I'm like, okay, they're soldiers. They're training. Accidents are going to happen. Could it happen to my son? Absolutely can happen. I don't blame them. There wasn't, you know, now you get into neglect and what the, okay, I wasn't talking about that. I don't know how those vehicles were maintained. I don't know whose job it was. I don't know it was a lack of judgment on maintenance or if it was just an accident. I wasn't talking about that. All I was talking about was the fact that accidents happen. You can die on deployment. You can die in a training accident. That kind of goes along when you raise your hand and sign the paper, you know, that, you know, you don't train in safety either. You know, you train dangerously at some things you guys do. So I wasn't, just need you to know out loud that even though it was a tragedy and my heart was breaking for how that went down, I don't think you don't ever stop training. You can't quit the policies that are there. You know, could you tighten up some things? Yeah, maybe. But that can happen anywhere and all over the world. There can always be improvement. But it was a tragedy. I couldn't, but that was the thing too, is that all of a sudden, I'm calling my daughter to find out if you were there because it was right where you were. And like you said, you were on the boat.
Yeah.
And I'm calling her and she's crying going, they've blacked out everything. I can't get a hold of my husband. They're not telling us anything. None of us in the family knew if you were on one of those crafts. We didn't know if you were in the water. We had no idea. And for hours and hours and hours, did they black you guys out? No phones, no email, no nothing? Is there a way the boats can do that?
So they didn't like, from what I know, they didn't like put anything that blocked any of our signal going in or out. I mean, obviously when you're out kind of in the ocean, you know, there ain't cell phone towers out there. Service is limited, but they do tell you, you know, hey, don't start, you know, posting on social media, blah, blah, blah. And the biggest reason why is because that's the last way a family wants to find out that something's happened to their child is about reading a post, and they don't want to cause, you know, panic and stuff like that, because it never makes anything better, you know.
And all the stories on social media, if 20 soldiers posted 20 different stories, they're all going to be wrong. They're all going to be different. They're not going to be a complete picture of what's going on anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, mostly just out of respect for the families of, you know, the people who were, you know, actually involved. Most people aren't going to
say anything. Super hard on your wife, my daughter. Yeah. It was super hard on all of us as family, because we were calling every half hour. We were watching every channel of news trying to get a glimpse. You know, cameras were showing people and soldiers doing stuff. We were relegated to hoping to see you on camera on accident. Like, wait, I think that was Mike. I think he's okay. I saw him walk by right there. That's what it felt like on our end, just so you know. It's just the not knowing. It's tough. But, so from the training on the coast to the accidents that happened, and it was just, I'm glad you didn't go down with the ship, so to speak. That would have been bad. What is it, speaking of that, what's the toughest training you've ever done? After you got out of basic training, after you got through with your classes, maybe the toughest isn't really the word I'm asking for. What did you feel this is dangerous, I really got to keep my head focused? Was there any live ammunition training or something you went through that was kind of like, you realize this is serious, even training?
I mean, there was never anything that I felt like maybe my life was like at risk or anything like that. Specifically, there is some, you do like live ammunition training. There's stuff like towards the end where you're crawling around and they're firing live ammunition.
Well, that's what we see in the movies. Yeah. We see them crawling under, you see you guys crawling under the barbed wire with tracers going 6 inches over your head. That seems pretty dangerous to me.
Yeah. And in reality, in the real life scenario, it's not. They're well above, like, even if you were to have something happen where you stood up, they're still firing well above your head, where that's not the case.
Well, Hollywood paints a different picture.
Yeah, Hollywood always paints a different picture.
Oh, well, the training's just got to be incredibly hard. Yeah. Let's go on now. So you do this helicopter stuff. You're getting better at it. You're getting promoted. You're going through the ranks. You're really doing your job very well. So you know the helicopter's inside and out. I don't know if you can talk about this or not, because you weren't there. You were giving me some speculation, but there was some of the types or similar helicopters that you work on that supposedly we left in Afghanistan when we had that pullout.
Yeah,
you were like, "Don't worry." You couldn't speak for everybody. You couldn't speak for all the equipment over there, but you assured me they're not going to use these helicopters. And I said, "Why?" And you said something about a bolt that would break that the helicopter wouldn't spin or something. It was, and I was like, "And can they fix that?" And you're like, "No, they're not. There's nothing they can do to fix that. That's strictly us." Yeah. I don't remember what that was, but that was the coolest thing that I heard. Was you guys are, it's like pulling a pin as you walk out the door and going, there's your big hunk of junk. You ain't using it now. What was that?
Yeah. So I can't, obviously, like you were saying, I can't speak specifically to those, helicopters, but I know there's definitely stuff like with ours that if we wanted to make the helicopter like inoperable, we could, by like removing minimal things.
There's an extreme possibility that soldiers over there could have made that equipment. They couldn't use it.
Yeah,
that's great. Sure. I love knowing that.
It's just
like, can you imagine some guys rolling in and going, "Look, we got these 10 big, well, I don't know, Seahawks or whatever they are. We're going to use these and we're going to make war." And then they can't fire them up, or they can't fly them up in the air or something. I mean, what a bunch of, how disappointing.
It was funny. So I was on a boat once, and we were out next to Somalia. And we just kind of started having a conversation amongst ourselves, and we're like, obviously it would never happen, but could you imagine if somehow some of these Somalian pirates on their little rinky-dink boats found a way to overtake us and get on the boat, get us all of us off or captive or whatever, and then they saw our helicopters and we're like, man, we're gonna fly these. Now, like, when we're on a boat, we have to like fold the blades. Right.
Yeah.
They get like folded up and put away. And it's, you know, it's quite a movement. It's quite an action. It's like has to be coordinated. There's like a supervisor of that, you have to go to special training.
You got to go to special training for the blades.
To fold the blades, you like go through like you have to get do like a syllabus, and there's someone who knows how to do it who teaches you, and then there are, to do it, there has to be one of those people qualified to do that present.
Do they fold back in a perfect line, or do they actually get removed?
So for specifically the one that I work on, there's like you pull pins, like half pins, and the blades, they stay on, but like one pin will be out, and there's two pins that hold it in. So you remove one, and then the blade can pivot on the other.
I got you.
And you got one that goes forward, one that goes backwards. I mean, and even with people who, you know, have had been trained on this helicopter, how to work in and around it, and like one dude who's like a supervisor who's been trained specifically for folding the blades,
yeah,
you know, you can still run into issues and things can go sideways. So
that's with trained people that know,
and that's with trained people. So I couldn't even imagine someone who had no idea anything, like, hey, let's try to fly.
There was Molly Pirates trying to put drill holes in it and line stuff up.
And then also when the stuff happened in Afghanistan, there was like a joke going around too that it was like right after we left, the number one trending search on Google was how to fly Black Hawk helicopter. And then 10 minutes later, the number one trending search was how to fix Black Hawk helicopter.
Oh my God, that is the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. So we pull out of Afghanistan, then Google reports the number one search is how to fly military helicopters, then 10 days later, how to fix them.
Yeah. Because, I mean, even with us, even with our like trained pilots, whenever we have flights, whenever they're getting ready to go fly, do any kind of training, whatever the case may be,
yeah,
we are always tasked with, we have to have maintainers out there standing next to the helicopter ready to go for the pilots to call them in and be like, hey, I'm having this issue, this is going on,
right?
And honestly, more often than not, we get called in to fix, you know, little things here and there that come up, or even just to tell the pilot like, hey, you know, that's not that big of a deal, you know, you can fly with that, you know, we'll fix it, we'll just you know, Matt, put in a work order when you get back and we'll get it figured out.
It's amazing before I go on to talking about Afghanistan, even if there wasn't a general order given to soldiers to saying disable this, you know, change that, take this, even if that wasn't even a command, I just got this gut feeling that American soldiers on their way out the door, knowing they're leaving some of this gear behind, I got to believe that there's some soldiers that would have just fucked with it just because they could. Like, you know what? I'm pulling this circuit out. I'm putting it in my backpack and I'm taking it home. You know, you guys aren't getting this. I just got to imagine that even if it wasn't an order, there was enough American soldiers that did their own sort of sabotage because it was the right thing to do. That's in my brain, as I make stuff up, that's the way I feel about it. So I don't know if I'm right or not. I wasn't there. So, but I'd always hoped that would be the case.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And I'm sure that I'm 100% certain they were given directions to remove, because 100% they removed, obviously, any kind of communications gear that was on it, right? Radios, anything that could have, like, you know, compromised us.
Yeah.
And there's definitely, you know, I work with manufacturers, people. So Bell is the company that makes the helicopters that I work on. And I work with manufacturers, engineers of that helicopter all the time. So I'm sure people higher up are like, you know, hey, what can we do to, you know, render these useless?
Yeah.
And the manufacturers, engineers were like, hey, just pull this and this, you're good.
Cross these two wires. When they fire it up, it'll melt it.
Yeah.
So... you're specializing in these certain type of helicopters, specializing for the Marine Corps. Does anybody else, any of the branches of the armed service, use the helicopters that you work on? Is that something in the Navy also?
No, we're actually, the Marine Corps is the only one that has the specific one that I work on, but they are used in other places outside of the DOD. I know specifically the UH-1 is used a lot in like in the Coast Guard and stuff like that.
I got you.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this then. So you've been on several deployments. You've been around the world. You've been to other bases, but it wasn't sightseeing. You were actually going there at times to fix helicopters at other places. And I mean, I'm sure it was Marine Corps stuff, but if there's a Marine Corps base, let's say in Okinawa, and they're struggling with something, and they take your whole crew out there and you spend 6 weeks working on their helicopters. Has that ever happened? Have you had to go abroad, go around the world to help get other parts of your fleet up to spec just because of manpower or something?
No, not me personally, but they do have stuff in place where if there's like people struggling, they'll actually send like civilian contractors out there to help with you know, any issues you're having.
So what was the last, how many deployments have you been on?
Three.
Yep. And tell me about the first one. Where'd you go and what was the purpose of the deployment? Just to see if you could handle living on an aircraft carrier for a little while? I mean, what'd you do?
So the first deployment I went on, I didn't actually go on a boat. We just went over to Japan. It was less of an actual deployment and more of like a training cycle.
Okay.
Just kind of to like keep the squadron, I guess like knowledgeable in like what you need to do, like when you deploy, you know, it's more, and like,
but I don't even understand what that means. Why couldn't they, if you know how to work on a helicopter in Pendleton, mm-hmm. you know how to work on one in Japan. Why send you there? What are you training for there?
It's more so, about like the movement of it. Like, hey, let's pick everything. Can we pick everything up and move it somewhere else and continue operating?
Oh, all right. Okay. Yeah. All right. I get what you're saying. That's like mm-hmm. a supply chain type of thing. Can we have a
forward logistical
operating center and still function?
Yep.
Okay.
It's like a logistical kind of thing. Because another thing, too, that like, because the helicopters I work on were going to Afghanistan. You know, we were on a deployment cycle out there. That ended very shortly after I joined. And the thing that you have to consider when you're thinking about the Marine Corps and stuff like that is the majority of people get in, do a 4-year contract and get out. So if you're on a cycle of deployments, those people are going to go most likely go on one deployment and be gone.
Right.
You know what I mean? So if we weren't doing this like deployment training stuff, you know, there would be almost nobody at our squadron, especially in like lower level positions, which are right. doing the groundwork, you know,
sure. Yeah.
That had deployed before. So let's say they were, you know, something obviously given current events, if something was to happen, they're like, hey, let's deploy. We would have a whole lot of people that would have no idea what they're doing.
Anything that's going on. Okay.
Correct.
Now that makes more sense.
Yeah.
So that was your first deployment. That was your primary function, was just practicing having a forward base for repair out of far away.
Yep.
See if you can get the yep. parts there, the supplies there, the helicopters yep. there, the tools, equipment, feed everybody, keep... That's a huge undertaking.
When you
think about it,
yeah.
That's incredibly hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So where was your second deployment? What did you do there?
So the second deployment, I was on a boat this time. I was a part of a Marine Expeditionary Unit. And we went all over the place, actually. I boarded in... California, and we sailed all the way over to the eastern side of Africa and went, you know, we were all around in the Middle East and stuff like that.
And what was the purpose of that one? What was the intention?
So the initial intention with the Marine Corps is that we and the Navy, we always have people over there. So it was just our turn to be over there, and we're kind of just patrolling the area. There was some stuff that we kind of like got involved with and helped out with and whatnot, but I'm not really sure where I can go into detail with that stuff.
That's
so.
All right. That's yeah. I don't want you to get fired.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But now that's something I didn't know. Maybe there's a lot of people. I'm sure there's a lot of military people and liaisons that do know that kind of stuff, but I didn't know. I know that we have bases and we have soldiers all over the world at all times, but
yep.
that would make sense. You wouldn't just put a base over there and have, you know, 10,000 soldiers sitting there. It's you can rotate people around as you go, and there's 6 mm-hmm. weeks of these guys and 6 weeks of these guys. That'd be good for the soldiers too. You get an idea mm-hmm. on what's going on, what the temperatures and humidities and the languages and the cultures. You really yep. get a little bit of a taste of that if they take you all over. That's not bad. I wouldn't even have thought of that, but that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's good. So that was your second one, was just kind of being a presence. The expeditionary force was moving around at different places, and that
yep.
was it?
Yep, we were just kind of being a presence.
All right. So what was your third one, your last deployment? What'd you do there?
So the last one I went on was kind of a combination of the first two. Initially, it was kind of a part of kind of just the training part. But then I also went with I joined up with the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit, which is more of like a training one. We're there to like kind of train how to be on a boat, how to operate with boats. But specifically, we did like integrated training with the Japanese.
How was that? Because that was probably your first interaction with another military, working with them.
So that was my first real interaction, like working with like the Japanese military. I had worked with a few other countries and their militaries prior to that. That was the first with Japan. And like working with them, it was really cool because there was definitely, that was the first time I worked with any other force where there was like a language barrier.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a cool experience. Like, you know, working with someone who wanted to work with you, but you couldn't just have a regular conversation.
Well, and again, I'm looking at this from an outside perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 2 or 3 years specifically, maybe even the last 18 months, the South China Sea is a hotbed of activity.
Yep.
And Japan, I know that one of the things when I was doing some homework and I was realizing China's reach and what they were pushing back on everybody, and they were leaning into everybody who's part of who has a shoreline in the South China Sea. They were like, this is ours, stay out of it, it's our area. And Vietnam's like, no, it's not. The Philippines, no, it's not. Taiwan, no, it's not. Everybody was saying, you can't just claim this. And then I found out that they, instead of just caving in, they all ran to Japan and said, we need to sign something where we're all sticking together on this. And they did. Couple years back, they all said, okay, well, we're sticking together on this. We're all claiming this is international waters. It's all for all. And now China's not dealing with one individual person, one individual country. Now they're dealing with 13 because they're all working together. I got to think that Japan is in hurry-up mode for catching up their military, catching up their Navy, because they're always talking. It's always in the news that Japan has just allocated more money for more ships, more planes, Taiwan, more ships. Everyone's allocating more money because they're worried about a conflict with China. Did you get that sense of urgency with Japan? Are they, you know, they kind of dedicated into hurry up and let's get up to speed here?
Oh yeah, 100%. Like working with them versus a lot of the other people that I've worked with, I definitely got like a, you know, everything that, even when we weren't even like specifically training with them, they were very eager to kind of be like, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, what's going on here?
You got to imagine they're so close to China. They're like, anything you can teach us, let us know, give us, help us, dude. There's got to be countries that are just thirsty for, you know, share with us, train us, help us.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big thing, but we have, I was going to ask you something too, and I'm not getting into the Israel area thing. We'll save that for last. But every time that China flexes its muscles, every time there was a news story I saw 2 days ago, the Chinese military was running into, I mean, physically running their boats into Coast Guard boats from other countries. And the Coast Guard is saying, we're still within like 12 miles, dude. You can't be here. We're 12 miles, you know, this is ours, and out there is international waters. And they start doing some shit, and they're flexing their muscles, and they're always doing practice runs on Taiwan. They've always got their Air Force and their Navy doing that. Well, they just recently sent in the Ronald Reagan. Now, I have been, it's kind of funny, I've been given to understand, people in the Navy have said, when you have a battle group that goes in, they always say, I don't care what stories you hear, the Ronald Reagan goes in armed. There's not a time they go, they're not going to go anywhere without all their weapons, all their food, all their soldiers. Mm-hmm. They're not like other navies. You know, when the Kursk got sunk, you heard about the Kursk getting sunk.
Yeah.
They went there without batteries. It was just their nuclear reactor. And they said, we're just going to go. We don't need the batteries this time. And a sub guy told me, he says, we'd never go out without all of our gear in any of our boats at all.
Nope.
We're ready to go or we don't go. And then I was told that, I just recently was very specifically told, when an aircraft carrier battle group goes to a theater, the ships that go along with it are tailored for that. It's not like the Reagan goes out every time with two destroyers and two fuel ships and two food ships and one sub and three, you know, Arleigh Burks. It's different by the mission. So I didn't realize that. I thought there was just a set group. When the Reagan leaves, these 12 ships leave or whatever. But it's not like that. It's like they have ships going for what they might encounter. Mm-hmm. So they take the USS Reagan and they ship it out over there. That seems to be a huge deterrent hand, because everyone that I've talked to, all the little incidents that China,
yep.
In, a deterrent for China, that every time all these incidents and things where China's flexing its muscles and doing things, it all stops in the area where the Reagan is. They don't do that shit very often at all with our ships. There's been a couple I've seen where they get close to our boats, but almost always that they move on and they're messing with people somewhere else. How long can the Reagan stay over there, kind of on patrol in the South China Sea, keeping an eye on everything? How long can they stay there with all those ships?
I mean, I know that I've definitely seen like battle carrier groups like stay in areas for very long periods of time, especially during COVID. I can't remember exactly which group it was, but they got stuck over there for a while just due to, like, you know, trying to contain, yeah, you know, quarantine, whatever the case may be. But they were over there for, you know, long time. What is like the technical, you know, specifications of it, I'm not sure. But the other thing I will say is it's not the only one. Like, if they're leaving, someone else is coming in. We're always going to have a presence over there, and China's always going to try to, like, you know, see what they can get away with, kind of poke here, poke there. I feel like
it just doesn't seem smart to count. I know this is a dumb civilian way to look at it.
Yeah.
But it's almost like China is counting on the restraint of a pilot, the restraint of a skipper, because at any moment someone could snap and whatever we're doing over there, our ship would wipe out their ship. Our plane would wipe out their plane. And it's like, guy, they're just, like you say, they're poking, but
yeah,
they're really counting on the restraint.
That's kind of like what they're testing, I would say, is they're kind of curious to see what they can get away with and how much we would get involved or how much we would retaliate. You know, because America is definitely always under the microscope. Everyone's always kind of looking at us. You know, we're expected to, you know, hold the standard. Everyone's like, oh, you know.
I wish we weren't. I wish we just knocked shit down and go, you're bad people doing a bad thing, and if you don't stop, we're going to stop you. We're not going to lose sleep over it. We're going to move on protecting people that need to be protected. We're going to protect the innocent. And if you do this, we're not going to show restraint. We're going to smack you, and then we're going to go on with life. I wish we had that, because then people like China wouldn't be poking at us.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you think about it, kind of like the most recent 4 years compared to the 4 years prior and kind of what was happening around the world. I feel like there was definitely a reason why no one, like Russia and China, weren't really doing too much. And now they've definitely ramped up.
As people would say, we had the crazy orange man in the White House that was like, pull the trigger. I really don't care. I'm tired of bad people doing bad things. I think that was a big part of it. And with every administration that I've ever lived under, you always have a different feel of what they're going to do. You did with Reagan, you know, you did with Clinton, you did with Bush, you did with Obama. You just get it. Whether you voted for them or not doesn't matter. You get a sense of what they're going to do. And if you sense they're going to do something, then the countries have a tendency to pull back a little bit. Not that they don't create problems, they do, but it just, there's a vibe, man. There's a vibe in the White House.
Yep.
So now we move on to where you are currently. You're still serving in Pendleton, and I know you're moving towards a non-deployable position. I know it's not instructor. You're going to be a recruiter?
A recruiter.
All right.
Correct.
So you're moving away from boots on the ground, although you're not there yet.
Yep, not there yet.
You very easily could be deployed tomorrow if they said so. You're not behind a desk anywhere. You could go.
Sure.
Over there, if you've heard recently, there's a problem going on in Israel.
Yeah.
You might have noticed that on the news. And the basic, I'm not going to rehash everything that's on the news. Those guys probably know more than I do anyway. I get some information, but most of it's what's already covered. But you basically have Israel surrounding Gaza, the Gaza Strip, and they're going to go wipe out Hamas. And they're not intending on leveling the whole Gaza Strip. They're not intending on hurting any Palestinians. They're just going to get rid of Hamas. We also have Hezbollah to the north that is, like you say, poking holes. They're just messing with stuff. And they're kind of the varsity team of this. Hamas is nothing compared to Hezbollah.
Yeah.
And Hezbollah is the varsity team. Iran trains and backs them both. So you got, for the first time in my life, I've never heard of, and it maybe probably happened, but I didn't hear about it. There's two battle groups in the Med. There's the Ford and its strike group and the Eisenhower. And I was told there's smaller aircraft carriers you guys have. You know, they're not the big Nimitz class, but there's other small carriers with smaller detachments of groups. There's several of them spaced out over Cyprus and in the Persian Gulf and in the Red Sea. It's not like those are the only two assets we have there.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of that just kind of goes back to what I like. If that second deployment that I went on, if that was happening right now, I'd be there.
They'd move you in that direction.
We would have been in the area already. They would have been like, hey, we're going to go kind of position a little up closer and just kind of be a presence, like, you know. And I think it's like super important, and that's part of the thing that I feel like a lot of people don't really understand, and why it's like, it's super important, especially for America, to show strength, to like flex its muscles per se, because it prevents, being strong prevents things from happening. Like, if people think that, hey, if I do this, America's going to come in and wipe me off the face of the earth, they're probably just not going to do that thing.
Yeah. Strength is a deterrent.
It is.
It absolutely is. And I'm glad we're over there. Now, I'm a little worried. You know, some of the, you hear analysts all the time, retired generals, you got all these people, you got active people and inactive people. They've all got their scenarios. The one guy that I talked to, and I'm not allowed to bring up anything about him, but I will tell you, he works his job, his company, liaisons all the drones to the military. When the military says, we get these drones to go do this thing and do this stuff, then he says, okay. And then the civilian side, he goes, look, I know the military says this, but this is what they really want. He liaisons that and makes it work. But he just went completely dark with this. He goes, I can't even come on your show and talk about Coca-Cola. I can't talk about McDonald's. If they hear my voice, I'm in trouble. He's dark. Sure. But what he did tell me before he had to go dark was, one of the things to worry about was that, and I got this from another person too, that is going to be on the program in a week or so, putting these two things together. So I'll tell you, is that two things come to mind, that there's two basic points, and I've talked about this openly in the live streams before, but one is, if Israel occupies Gaza, if they go into the Gaza Strip, clear everybody out, restore the food, restore the water, kind of have order, my thing as a dumb civilian is stay there, occupy it. Just tell the whole world, say, we're not going to go through this again. We're not going to go through it one more time. You're not going to build your army. You're not going to attack us. We're just taking over Gaza. Tough shit. You know, run your government, elect your officials, but we're not leaving. Yep. We're not going to do that again. Why is that important? Because Israel occupying Gaza, in the view of the world, the UN, is the same as Russia occupying Ukraine. We can't say it's okay for Israel to do it, but it's not okay for Russia. Russia, you need to get out. And this couple people have told me that are pretty high up now have said, if that situation stands in when the UN says, has to publicly say, all right, you've been there for 3 months, you got to get out, you can't stay there. And Israel, if Israel were to stay there, you would have Russia, China, and other countries, North Korea, going, well, we're just going to enforce what the UN wants. We're just doing the UN's bidding. We're helping out the United Nations. We're going to go in there and we're going to get rid of Israel. We're going to kick them. We're going to do it. You can't stop us. We have the UN on our side. We're UN backed. That's what they just said. They said they condemned Israel and told Israel to get out.
Yeah.
It is a free license to go in there and do that. You could start trouble right then, and that would put the Western allies at odds with the UN and China and Russia. Not that Russia's a huge factor, but you get the idea that all of a sudden that puts you in, wait a minute, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. You can't do that. that's one aspect that could be coming that they could be waiting on. It's like, okay, all we need is approval. Now we're not doing something illegal. Mm-hmm. Now we're just supporting the UN. That's one. The other one that really didn't come to my attention until someone talked to me about a week ago was all of the chess pieces being moved around the board to try to de-escalate this, to try to bring this back down, to lower the temperature, draw the lines, and see who's doing what, all hinges on Saudi Arabia. All of it. They said that is that's the thing to look for. You're going to start hearing more about that in weeks to come because right now they're staying out of it. But eventually they're going to have to pick a side.
Yep.
And Saudi Arabia has been moving completely westernized in the last 10 years. They love that shit.
Yeah, a lot of people say, like, not necessarily like them specifically, but a big reason why this attack happened when it did was because Israel was at the table with Saudi Arabia.
Very close.
Trying to do peace.
They were so close. Trying to make a peace treaty. Working on a peace agreement for so long.
Yeah.
And they were almost there. And Iran's like, we're not having none of that.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know that from what I'm hearing from people, it didn't ruin it, but it definitely put it on pause.
Yep. It's definitely paused.
But if everyone who's aligning with the Emirates over there, the Emirates Empire or Association, and Saudi Arabia is the key, you're dragging other people with you with their vote, how they decide. If they're like, we're not going along with this, and Israel's got to change, that puts them against the West. If they decide, if the crown prince and everybody falls in line behind him, if they decide, Saudi Arabia says, we're sticking with the UN, we're sticking with the West, we like the way things are going, that all of a sudden, I've been told, that puts such immense pressure on Iran that now some pieces can be moved around the board going, look, if you do this, you can't, there's no way you can handle all of us. And now we're free to go fight over here. If China starts some shit, you know, because nobody wants to be in a two theater war. That's very difficult.
Yeah.
So the main thing was if Israel occupies Gaza, that's one. Where does that leave the UN? You can't play favorites. And the other one is Saudi Arabia. When they finally commit to a decision and a direction, that sets the tone for everything. It'll either bring stuff down quickly, temperatures come down, de-escalation comes down, you know, the fingers off the trigger. But if they don't, if they go against Israel, if they go against the West, that ramps things up. So everyone is doing their jobs right now, I've been told. Waiting to see it, which way they're going to go. And right now they're staying out of it. They're saying, hey, they're doing the typical, what everybody does. We don't like seeing innocent people die. You know, they shouldn't have attacked them. It's going to be tough. Make sure you don't. You just generically staying out of it. So what is Saudi Arabia's, other than financially, they got tons of cash and they have control over oil. What do they have for a military presence, one way or the other? I don't know anything about Saudi Arabia. I mean, do they have a top-notch military or air force or anything?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, as far as I know, I'm not too familiar with like what their specific military capabilities.
You haven't been sent to Saudi Arabia to fix helicopters, then?
I have not, and you know, they haven't really been involved in a lot of stuff, especially in that aspect. So it's kind of hard to say, but. Honestly, I'm not super sure about that.
I just would wonder I know there's a huge influence of countries that go along with them. I get that.
Yeah.
But I just, God, it'd just be so nice to have all of a sudden if Saudi Arabia turned and said, yeah, we're with Israel, we're with the UN, we're with the West, we're with the United States.
Yeah.
Because God damn, we could turn around in China and go, all right, now do you have something to say about this or not?
Yeah.
You know?
In my personal opinion, I feel like the likelihood of that is probably very low. You know, everybody wants to do, especially in that area, in that region,
that they're going to side with us,
that they'll openly like side with us and be like, hey, we're going to go with the West. It's really? Just like, I think that would oust them a lot from their neighboring countries.
Yeah, but they've gone, like you said, they were just about to sign peace with Israel.
Yeah,
that's the biggest no-no ever. You can't do that. And they're about to do it. And everything in their society, they're bringing in rock concerts now. They're changing to hotels and making everything green over there, building massive cities, embracing capitalism, and they're thriving on it. They love every bit of it.
Yeah.
Why would they give that up? They've been a decade of going one direction and to throw it away now when they were just a breath away from signing something with Israel. I'm going to differ with you on that one. You think it's low that they're going to side with the West? I'm thinking I've been listening to the Crown Prince speak for months now. And other than some shady stuff he's doing, I get it, kills reporters. We saw, you know, I'm not saying they're a democracy, but I'm just saying that I've listened to the guy talk, and the evidence is what they've been doing.
Yeah.
They're completely transforming their nations. Completely. I like that. I think they're going to side with the progress they've made. That would be my guess. But I'm a dumb mechanic in the middle of the desert. What do I know? All right. So let's go back to, if you were to be deployed in the Mediterranean or the Middle East, would where they deploy you, because I'm assuming there's different places they could, there's a base here or a base there or an aircraft carrier here that they could deploy your unit to. If they sent you guys over there, by where they sent you, would that give you a sense of what's going on? Like, huh, that's kind of weird. If they put us here, A, B, and C must be happening. If they put us over there, you know, D, E, and F. If they sent you guys to a specific place with your tactical helicopters, does that give you, and I'm not going to ask you for battle plans, of course, but would that give you a sense, your guys a sense of what's going on by where they send you?
Yeah, probably more than likely, just because the specific aircraft that I work on doesn't have a very long range. You know what I mean? So I wouldn't be like, it wouldn't be really an option for me specifically to be very, like, we would not be far from the action.
From what their assignment is, what their mission is.
So if they're putting up us like on the northern side of Israel, okay, cool.
Lebanon and Hezbollah.
That, those dudes poked and prodded a little bit too much, and
now they got to deal with you guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
But how many base, do you know how many places, how many bases there are in Israel that your guys could be deployed to, or would they just make a base?
We would probably just make a base.
Really, just clear out some stuff and go, we're landing here.
Yeah, we'd probably just make like a FOB. Yeah.
That's incredible you guys can do that. Just set up headquarters and everything, and now you got a base of operations right there.
Yeah.
But that's the thing you and I kind of talked about before, is like, if you get deployed and they put you on an aircraft carrier, it's like, all right, we're still floating around seeing where we're going. But yeah, if they put you on the ground someplace, like you said, you kind of know what they're thinking by where you are. Well, I'm hoping you don't get deployed. I'm hoping this whole thing calms down. But
yes,
like we talked about, you're always a Marine first. And if they say, get your boots and your helmet and your weapon, let's go, you go.
Yep.
Period. End of story.
Yep.
So if the worst case scenario happened now, and I'm going to ask your opinion on a vague question of the military that, you know, anybody could answer with an opinion, because it's just you more so than me, obviously. But if we have all the assets over there and it ends up Hezbollah starts attacking, and everyone says, well, what if Iran attacks? And I first thought, well, how would they attack? Are they just they're going to roll in with tanks, or is it just going to be missiles? No one's really clear. Everyone throws that out there on the news. Well, you got to be careful if Iran gets involved and they attack with what? What are you talking about? I mean, we defeated the Iraqi military and they supposedly had way more of an army than Iran. So I don't get what you're saying. You know, what are you attacking with? But whatever it is, if they decided to attack and Hezbollah attacks, first of all, I'm pretty confident the United States and its allies could handle Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas, and it would, I mean, it would be terrible and it would be bloody, but there would be a confident victory there. Like, there's no chance they have it winning unless they started throwing nuclear weapons
around. Yeah, I think that right there is kind of the fear, is that, because 100%, like Iran, I mean, even Israel by itself could very likely, they would be spread thin, but they could very likely handle Hamas and Hezbollah at the same time. It's more of just like, I think we're just kind of there, not necessarily that they couldn't handle Hezbollah, and because they can handle, in my opinion, obviously this is just my opinion. Right. I think they could handle Hamas like with just basic ground forces,
right?
But their air force is
top notch.
Yeah. So I think, you know, they could do like an air force in the north, just kind of annihilate Hezbollah there.
Yeah, I think they could bring it to rubble. They could raise the whole city to the ground if they needed to.
I think the U.S. just kind of wants to prevent that from happening because of the implications that it brings with Iran. Sure. And again, it's us in Israel versus Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas.
That's always the underlying fear all the time, is if Iran's got nothing to lose, if Hamas is defeated, Hezbollah is defeated, now everybody's pissed at Iran, why not throw a nuclear weapon out there? We don't care. We're Iran. What do we got to lose? You guys are pissing us off. You've ruined everything. You've beat all of our ground forces. You know, why not throw a nuclear, even if you're not going to bomb Israel? Couldn't they launch a couple of nukes out into the Mediterranean where our battle groups are and get close? I mean, when you use a nuclear weapon, you don't got to have pinpoint accuracy, do you? I mean, you're going to cause damage. I mean, that's always the fear, is why wouldn't they just, all right, who cares? Who cares anymore? Let's just launch some nukes and let's get it on. We're losing anyway.
Yeah.
That's the thing that as just a common civilian citizen, I'm worried about.
Yeah.
I'm worried about that factor.
I think that's like the biggest, that's definitely the biggest fear for sure, is that if Iran does want to get involved and the U.S. does what it needs to against them, that's going to be really their only option.
Why can't we just walk over there, knock on their door and go, if you fire one nuke, we're going to turn your country into a fucking parking lot. Just so you know, there, you won't ever know if you won or lost. You're never going to know if your missile even hit anybody, because before it does, we're going to glass your whole country. So if you want your whole country to be a parking lot, go ahead. Otherwise, I'm going to leave now, and you guys need to practice some common sense and restraint. I don't know why, since we talked about America's presence being a deterrent, it's only good if you use it.
Yeah.
Just like in the Cold War, it's like there was always the threat of complete annihilation between Russia and the United States. No one wanted to pull the trigger because the other one had already said, if you send one, we're sending 1,000. And Russia did the same thing. Russia was like, you shoot one at us, we're going to send 1,000 your way. The whole mutual annihilation was what kept the Cold War in check quite often.
Yep.
It's only this having a big stick is only good if they know you're going to use it.
Yeah.
I think Iran needs to know that it's like, look, we're not messing around. Because just even I'm not even talking about the aircraft carriers that are there. Think about the nuclear subs we have in the area that have all those intercontinental ballistic missiles on them that can just, and you'll never find them. You're never going to find those guys.
Yep.
So I don't know. I'm worried about that. But let's move on to sunny point number two.
Mm-hmm.
We were just talking about Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran. All right. What if China decides, while we're doing all this, they want to invade Taiwan? First of all, in your opinion, could we stop them from invading Taiwan?
Yes. I personally believe so. I think kind of like what happened with Russia is like it. The perception has always kind of been that the only people that could match the U.S. in the military was Russia and China.
Right.
And now Russia's over here having issues with little old Ukraine. Sure, they've got some, you know, backup from us, a little bit of funding.
Nothing like we all thought.
Yeah, it was not the way we thought it was going to go. And there's an argument to be made on both sides, but I personally believe that China is in the same boat. I think that their military is a smokescreen. I think they put things out there and they say certain things, and like, what are the numbers that they put out? Honestly, if you know whether you believe those or not, I honestly don't.
Well, here's two things. One is, you know, they're building aircraft carriers.
Sure.
And they're okay. I don't like their carriers. I don't like those ramp carriers at all.
Yeah.
When you study that, the planes can't be as big. They can't carry as much off those. You can't bring as much armament as you can off of our Nimitz class. Not even close. Not even night and day. The ramp actually short, it changes the dynamics of everything and limits your sorties you can fly in all sorts of ways. So I think their aircraft carriers themselves are inferior. Yeah. But here's the, and I get into arguments with people like, oh, you don't understand. China's been training and they got thousands and thousands of men and they're ready to go and they got two aircraft carriers and they're building two more. It's like, does it not ever sink into anybody that the Navy has been in actual wars with aircraft carriers, mm-hmm. that we've actually, we train by what we know is a combat situation? That one of the things that was, it was so interesting when I studied the Battle of Midway, when mm-hmm. It was kind of a turning point, as they say, in the war, was that, you know, one of the things that caused the Japanese to lose their carriers was their crew of fire control people were not nearly as good as ours. When we got bombed on the Yorktown, and the planes bomb the Yorktown, see it on fire, and it gets engulfed in flames. They go back and say, we sunk one. They send another airplane squadron out. They say, oh, look, there's another aircraft carrier just sitting there floating. No smoke, no damage, no nothing. Same ship. But our crew could save those ships. We were trained. We knew what to do. Mm-hmm. We knew how to do fire suppression. We knew how to get organized. They'd been doing it, learning the same with the Japanese. The Japanese couldn't put out their fires. I'm telling you, there's something to be said about our Navy and how they operate aircraft carriers. These boys know how to get out there and do their job. How mm-hmm. does China? They've never been in a combat situation with their aircraft carriers. They've mm-hmm. never been in real life situations. They can read a manual. Someone could steal the manual off of one of our aircraft carriers and go, well, we got to have this many men to do this and this many people to do that. But it's different when you're actually out there doing it. Yeah. And our Navy's been doing it for 70 years. I don't see how anybody can compare a Chinese Navy with new ships, commanders that have never had, they don't have any history on their side of going and doing these things, to what we've got in our United States Navy.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I don't think they could stand to us at all. I mean, and there's definitely something to be said about the generational knowledge that's like within our Navy. I mean, even with for my job, in the helicopters, sure, we have manuals and stuff that tell us how to fix things and do this and do that. But there's countless things within that manual that when a brand new guy comes in and he has no idea what he's doing, you know, he's been to the basic school, that's it, cool, he knows how to read the manual, and now he's trying to implement the manual, it's not always the best way to go about things.
No, and you're talking about, look at your years of experience mm-hmm. on a helicopter, and you still get into situations diagnosing things, you're like, okay, I know everything about this, I'm up to speed as much as anybody on the planet, and you still have to struggle to diagnose it. You can't just plug a computer in and it figures it out for you. There's some skill level that goes along. Yeah. How are they going to do that stuff with their aircraft that they're stealing blueprints and building these airplanes? What happens when it doesn't quite fly right?
Yeah.
And they come back and go, the pilot says, yeah, it's kind of doing this. There's a little bit too much yaw rate or something. Who are mm-hmm. they going to tell? They're like, well, I didn't design this plane. I'm just building it off the specs. Yeah. There's no depth there. I don't understand how come no one pays attention to that factor when it comes to China just being stolen or given all these blueprints. Like, oh, and automatically you get 100 years experience too?
Yeah.
Come on, man.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of experience that goes into that. And I'm like, you know, even for me, I'm getting ready to leave. You know, I'm trying to pass along as much of that as possible, just like the guys before me, you know, did to me. So there's a lot of like stuff there that, and then even with that stuff, like I was saying earlier, there's still times where like I have phone numbers and we got little business cards of engineers, people who work for the manufacturer, and I can call them up and we can get people out there and working on like, you know, stuff that comes up that I'm like, man, I'm not really understanding why what's happening is happening. And they can come out and be like, hey, this is how it's designed to work. This is how it's supposed to be. And I'm like, well, yeah, look at this. And they're like, well, yeah, that's pretty interesting. And I can work with them and we can get it figured out.
And guess what? Those guys don't go. They don't go to China and help them.
Yep, they sure don't.
I see what you're saying. I agree with you on this. The propaganda mm-hmm. far outweighs, I think, what the meat and substance behind the pictures are. I just don't see it. I don't see the experience there for they just don't have it. They just, because they haven't gone through it yet.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about our Navy's been doing this for, 200 years, and the last 70 or 80 years with modern machines, our Navy, our Marine Corps, our Army has learned harshly and shed away the stuff that doesn't work, amplified the stuff that does, and is improving on it. Yeah. China has to go through a learning curve.
Yeah.
Their tactics, they look good on paper, but until you have a commander standing there in battle, that's a whole different feel, man.
Yeah, and the best learning curves usually come with devastating losses.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I just don't see when they, every time they talk about China matching what we have, it's always just numbers.
Yeah.
That's all it always is.
And another thing, too, that I feel like is, I don't really think I've ever seen it talked about, is Chinese like willingness from, the lowest level person, especially with the way they handled COVID and how things were dealt over there.
They handle their people. Look at their economy with everyone can't get their money out of their banks. They're always, China's always, every year, food is on a razor's edge. Mm-hmm. They import so much food because of their, they don't have the, this is like a common thing that everyone knows. They talk about all the time. It's like food.
Yeah.
It's a huge, big thing right there. So you're always teetering on food. You've lost your economy with money. There's buildings and housing that have just sitting empty because they've overbuilt and underproduced.
Yep.
Everything's shaky over there right now. There's like four experts on China that I listen to regularly. Mm-hmm. All these guys do is study China. That's all they've done. They're professors. All they've done for 30 years. They absolutely can tell you every person, every player, every face. They can tell you every decision that they've made and how it's gone good or bad. They're very fair about this. But all four of them agree that China is on the verge of severe turmoil.
Yeah.
Now, when they say that to me, I say, well, again, just like Iran, why not start an attack? Start a war.
Yeah.
We're going to run out of, that's the other one. They're going to run out of people.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard about that. I didn't really realize that till a couple of years ago. When I was growing up, it was always a thing we were told, China can only have one kid.
Yeah.
The one kid policy, and it better be a boy. Well, all of a sudden, they've miscalculated either on purpose or on accident, and it came out this last year, and these four professors that I listened to, these guys have said they're in trouble, huge. You can't just invent 20-year-olds. You can't just invent 30-year-olds. They are running out. These people are getting old, retiring, dying, moving on.
Yeah.
And they're realizing that having that one child policy is now going to kill them. They can't, now they've lifted it. Have kids, let's go.
Yeah.
But now there's a gap. There's a time period. There's a decade where they're not going to have people working. They're not going to have enough.
Mm-hmm.
Their infrastructure for all the stuff they produce and send out, their military, everything is going to be affected by this.
Yeah,
because they're short. All four guys independently say this is one of their big concerns. Well, before that gets there, why not attack? I mean, if you had to wait for the perfect storm, it's like, well, if I was China, if I was President Xi, I'd be thinking, all right, I'm going to wait till there's a weak White House, not as prone to fight. Mm-hmm. I'm going to wait till there's a conflict overseas where America's looking the other way. And before I run out of money and food and people, because I'm running out of all right now, I got one shot at this before there's a civil war here, I'm going to make a move on something. Now, I'm not saying they're going to take over the whole South China Sea, but they definitely would make a move on Taiwan.
Taiwan, yeah, they want that pretty bad.
If they were ever going to make a move, what more would you be waiting for? Are you can someone come along and say, well, China could do that, but they're really waiting for this one more situation to kind of go their way, then they'll do it. All right, name it.
Yeah.
Name one more thing they'd be waiting for, and I haven't been able to find anybody to tell me one yet.
Yeah.
I'm worried.
Yeah, I was talking with my wife earlier too, is like another thing that's kind of scary about it is the fact that we have an upcoming election. And the way that Trump kind of looks in the polls right now, I mean, obviously him versus Biden polls are kind of, most people are looking at the primaries, but where he is dominating. So I feel like a lot of these people are looking at that and are like, especially China, they, in their head, they could be like, hey,
the clock's ticking.
This is our last chance.
Right. If we're going to make a move, we better make it now. Now, contrary to what you just said, you're just your opinion, just throwing out the top of your head. You're like, we could stop China from invading Taiwan. A couple of guys that I talked to said we're not in a position to do that. We don't have ground forces over there. If they decided to just race across and invade Taiwan, not much could stop them. And we could go, we'd have to go root them out of there. Just, they've been very frank with me saying, just so you know, if China really wanted to just, you know, put 600,000 men race across there in boats and airplanes, they take over Taiwan. All right, we go get them out, but it's going to be a fight to get them out. But that would be the way. There's really not, they said at this moment, we don't have a mechanism in place. I mean, if we lined up, you know, two divisions of Marines on the beach, we could stop them.
Yeah,
but we just—they said just realize if they want to, it'd be a mop-up effort to go root them out of there. I'd rather be with you, and we wouldn't let them in. But I don't know that they're confident we have assets in place as they're swarming across to Taiwan. Do we have assets to intercept them and stop them?
We do. One, I can tell you with 100% certainty, we have assets in that area all the time.
If there's enough to stop them, I feel better already. That feels great.
and I think there's something to be said, too, about Taiwan themselves. They have a military. It's not like they're just over there like, man, I sure hope America comes and saves us. You know,
I don't picture them riding bicycles around.
Yeah. And you got to think, like, what does their military train for? Their military trains for one thing and one thing only, and that's China invading.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that they've, you know, would we be there the instant the invasion started? No. But do I think we would be there
in about half an hour?
Within 24 hours? Yes. And do I think that they could hold China off until we pulled in and flanked China? 100%.
Yeah. Good.
And I think that that's something that definitely China considers is like, you know, how long would our invasion take and would America be here within that time?
And how there's no way that, you know, you picture a running back taking a football and plowing through the line and they put their arm out to stiff arm somebody, you know, to get them away long enough to get across the line. There is no way that China could stiff arm the United States and go, well, if the United States swarmed over to help Taiwan, we could hold them back for a minute here while we finished our invasion. No way could they do. They're not a possibility at all. They'd get their arm broke if they did that. You can't stiff arm us.
Yeah.
No way. The only thing that comes into play in these conversations that's a wild card, and this is what people tell me is the wild card, and I've got two parts to the story. China, and of course Russia says it, but China claims with certainty they have a missile that can sink an aircraft carrier. They have claimed that for about a year and a half now. Supersonic missile. They say you can't stop it. We couldn't stop it if it was aimed at us. You can't stop it if it aimed at you. And so you put over two carriers over here. We're going to take two missiles and sink two of your carriers. That's been their mantra for about 2 years now. And they show pictures and they talk about it and that's it. The only thing that makes me feel okay about what they said, like they might be lying, is I saw an interview one time where there was a naval rear admiral and it was brought up to him he was taking questions. Mm-hmm. And they said, hey, China has this weapon. Do you think it exists? And he says, I don't know. Maybe they got one. He goes, well, aren't you worried about it sinking the carriers if they actually built this? He goes, nope, not even a little bit. That's all he said. He didn't elaborate on if there was a space laser that would shoot it down. He didn't talk about, you know, throwing up lead to hit this thing before. He didn't elaborate at all. He just said, nah, I don't know if there is one or not. Maybe they got one. So what? And like, well, you're not worried about hitting it? No, not even a little bit. He acknowledged maybe they have one. Not going to hit us. I have no idea what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. Don't even care. As long as he's that confident, then that takes that chess move off the table. It's off the board. You know, that's not that's been their big threat was, oh, the mighty aircraft carrier. You guys rely on your aircraft carriers way too much. Well, tell you what, we're going to take those out. And then this guy comes out and goes, no, you're not. That was huge for me as a person, as an American citizen. Now, I don't know. That's probably not your area, but is there ever a worry when if you were on an aircraft carrier over in the South China Sea, would you be worried about a supersonic missile coming from China to sink the boat you're on?
Honestly, no. Like, when you first started bringing it up, the first thought I had when you were like, oh, yeah, they got this missile and they swear it can sink carriers, the first thought I had was, well, yeah, you got to hit it first. And good luck with that.
Well, now that you say that, there was another documentary where a naval expert said, you don't understand the logistics in the handing off of information between planes and boats and satellites that keep a missile on track.
Yeah,
he said, just you don't get it. It isn't just point and shoot, and there's not a camera on the end of this missile that looks at what it wants to go hit, and it drives itself there. They actually had, I forgot about this, they had pictures of how satellites and ships and planes relay information to keep a long-range missile where it's going.
Yep.
That's pretty complicated. I mean, if we took out two satellites of theirs, that's done. You're through. You're not doing anything. You're just blindly shooting out of the ocean then. Yeah. I had forgotten about that. Thanks for reminding me. That's a good point. Good luck hitting it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, especially something going that fast. You can't use an Atari joystick and steer that thing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, man. I appreciate all of your insight. I appreciate you taking time. I know we ran a little bit long, but
no, it's fine.
What a great interview. You've answered everything. Given me a ton of new information and respect for the Marine Corps, stuff I didn't know. And I like that, you know, when you're in any industry, I don't care if you're in the food industry, you know the scuttlebutt of what's true and what's not about the food industry. If you're in the automotive industry, you know the scuttlebutt. You know what's going on, even though the news and people talk, but you're like in the industry, so you know. You're in the Marines. You're in the military. When you give me an answer with a certain degree of confidence, that makes me feel better because you get a vibe. You may not know the specific battle plan of the United States with Israel, but you're like, doesn't matter. When these guys get their shit together, I know the result. We win. I like that attitude. I like the feeling that way. I like that I know there's things that are unpredictable and some things can come up and nothing ever goes exactly as planned. But the idea that you're not super worried about every little thing makes me feel better.
Yeah.
You know, and you're just in the know. There's stuff you know that the rest of us don't. Other soldiers may know it too. It's not like you're the only person who knows, but I bet if I sat down 200 other Marines like you and did the same interview, I'd come away feeling the same way. And I like that feeling. Well, Mike, thanks a lot for doing this interview. Thanks for taking time. I know you got to get on with your day. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for sticking around, whether you're watching the video portion of this or just listening as you're driving around. I hope you got some good information out of this. It's not often we get somebody who's got some real boots on the ground, hands-on experience, who's been around the world. Remember, the whole thing with Gen X Talks is we look at things with nuts and bolts. We don't get lost and confused with all the focus groups and the charts and the graphs and all the politics of it. Just keep it simple. Keep it just at street level. Look out your front door, tell them what's going on. Well, you're talking to a guy, you're listening to a guy who came in studio and just says, all right, well, when I lace up my boots and I look out across the base, you want to know, I'll tell you what's going on. You can't get much more basic than that. And as you notice, we didn't get too deep into everything. You just get the sense and the vibe. I hope it made you guys feel good too. All right, I got to go. I got to get out of here. There's many more things to do. Remember two things. Wherever you go, there you are. And I'll catch you guys on the flip side.